Well, in our study, we're in the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation, and we're discussing the fall of Babylon the Great. This chapter and the book of Revelation has, in times gone by, been considered one of the most difficult studies in the Bible. I'm not necessarily convinced that that's entirely true. There are some other contexts that I think are equally difficult. Of course, the Apostle Peter, as he was writing in the close of the second epistle to the Jews who had become Christians and dispersed, in chapter 3, referred to the writings of our beloved brother Paul, some of them being difficult, hard of interpretation, he said, which some would twist and pervert. And I don't know of any other illustration that surfaces more than the book of Revelation, because perversion is just a part of the explanation of some of the book of Revelation. In fact, I was reading some material yesterday that was looking at the book of Revelation in some kind of obscure futuristic interpretation to indicate that the things that are transpiring now, currently, are a fulfillment of what John is writing about in the book of Revelation. And for those of you that are somewhat new in our class, those of you who are younger, who have not been through the introductory material, I'm not going to go back and redo all that, but I do want to call your attention, because you're going to face this in your future when people begin to raise questions about current events and the book of Revelation. You want to know Revelation chapter 1, verses 1, 2, and 3. In Revelation chapter 1, verses 1, 2, and 3, you see the backdrop against which the interpretation of the book of Revelation needs to be set. It says in verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, when God gave him to show unto his servants even the things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John, who bare witness of the word of God and of the testimony of Jesus Christ, even of all things that he saw. Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of the prophecy, and keep the things which are written therein, for the time is at hand. Now, if you're in this class this morning and you're capable of reading, I would dare say you understand those three verses. Just read them. You can understand them. It is the revelation of Jesus Christ. God gave it to him to show to his servants things which must shortly come to pass. Now, just in that expression, and then the last expression, for the time is at hand, John is setting the stage for the rest of the book of Revelation. The time is at hand, things which must shortly come to pass. Now, that having been said, we just know that John is not writing about things that are thousands of years down the road from the time that he wrote it. What benefit would that be to those who would read and hear the words of this prophecy? Now, John is writing these things. He says that these things are signified. Now, we know from that expression that signs and symbols are part of the book. That's just a part of it. It's not the only book in the Bible that contains signs and symbols, but this one does. The book of Ezekiel in the Old Testament contains signs and symbols and other such books. But we can look in, for example, Zechariah as another illustration. But noting that there are signs and symbols that are used in a number of books of the Bible, this is just one of them. It's exclusive to the New Testament, because other New Testament books are not written in signs and symbols. Now, the word apocalypse, I was talking with Richard just a moment ago, and he was commenting about the list of songs and the notes that he keeps in his little notebook. And last time that he had notes about leading the singing was March of 2020, I believe he said. And he said he was going to write down right below that apocalypse. Now, he was talking tongue-in-cheek about the virus. I understand that. But that is an illustration of how that often we look at the word apocalypse. And interesting to note that when you're reading the book of Revelation, that word revelation is translated from the Greek word apocalypse, which simply means an uncovering or an unveiling, a revealing of things that are to come to pass. It does not always indicate the second coming of Christ, and we've got to know that. But unfortunately, that's how it has been used in more recent years. And so you want to notice that in the first part of the book. Now, turn from that as we introduce our study today to the last chapter of the book of Revelation, chapter 22. And again, I want to call your attention to verse 6. It says, "And he said unto me, These words are faithful and true, and the Lord, the God of the spirits of the prophets, sent his angels to show his servants the things which must shortly come to pass. And behold, I come quickly. Blessed is he that keepeth the words of the prophecy of this book." You'll see the same thought or a similar thought expressed in verse 20 of this last chapter, Revelation 22. Now, having said that, that book ends the book of Revelation. It tells us in the beginning, the introduction, he's writing about things which must shortly come to pass. The book concludes, "I have been writing about things which must shortly come to pass." Now, what he says in the middle is the things that would pertain to those who would read the prophecy of this book, those in John's day that would read this prophecy, how that they might learn some things which was in their near future. And that's the subtotal or sum total of the book. Now, we've noted that the book divides itself naturally into two divisions. Chapters 1 through 11 that talks about things that were happening to them. And then a background or a backdrop against which those things would lay, beginning in chapter 12 going forward, to show that, yes, here in these first several chapters are things that early Christians were enduring, but the reason why they were enduring these things is because of this thing that's going on with God and the devil, if you please. And we see that introduced in chapter 12 going forward. Now, just short note, who's going to win? God or the devil? Well, God is. Who's going to win? Christians or those who would persecute Christians? Christians are. Now, if you can get that from the book of Revelation, then you've got the things that we want to take home with us. What we want to note in Revelation chapter 18 now is it, along with chapter 19, is somewhat of a continuation of thought of the fall of Babylon the Great. Now again, I'm going to say these things in part because of those who are joining us in this class who are teenagers, and sometimes we think, well, the book of Revelation is well beyond my ability to understand. I'm not convinced that that's true. I think that your study of the Bible can be profitable even in the book of Revelation. And we know that some of the signs and symbols that are used in the book of Revelation are found in the Old Testament. And when we read in the Old Testament of God's judgment upon cities and upon nations, we see some very vivid terms that are also used here in the book of Revelation. Now, in the book of Revelation, we've noted a number of times reference to Babylon, the fall of Babylon. Well, we might raise this question for those of you who have been students in the class and know that we've covered this in times gone by. Who was the Babylon of John's day? Now, we know that the kingdom of Babylon, the ancient kingdom of Babylon, has been gone for a long, long time. But in John's day, who was the Babylon that was responsible for persecuting those who were saints? It was Rome. It was Rome. And when we look at Rome and see the horrible things that Rome was doing, we see them described almost in identical terms to other cities that are the subjects of God's wrath in Old Testament times. And I want to spend a little bit of time developing that point for our study this morning. If you'll turn in your Bibles to some Old Testament text. Well, before I do that, it's, I guess, important for us to read the text that we're going to be considering this morning. And I want to begin that in verse 10 of the 18th chapter. Now, we're going to back up and fill in the blanks here. But I want to back up, if you would, please, to verse 2. Verse 2. We'll pick it up again at verse 10 a bit later. But in verse 2, "And he cried with a mighty voice, saying, Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, and is become a habitation of demons and a hold of every hidden or every unclean spirit, and a hold of every unclean and hateful bird. For by the wine of the wrath of her fornication, all the nations are fallen, and the kings of the earth committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth waxed rich by the power of her wantonness." Again, if you'll note in verse 12, reference to the great city Babylon, the strong city. Now, having said that, turn back with me to some Old Testament text, just to get the background of it. And let's go back, if you will, to Isaiah chapter 21. Isaiah chapter 21. Isaiah and Jeremiah have a great deal to say about the fall of ancient Babylon that was ruled over at one point by Nebuchadnezzar, the one that Daniel is speaking to, actually, in Daniel chapter 2 and other related passages. But in Isaiah chapter 21, look with me beginning in verse 9. Now, this is not the only passage we're going to look at in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 21 in verse 9. In verse 9, it says, "And behold, there cometh a troop of men, horsemen in pairs. And he answered and said, Fallen, fallen is Babylon, and all the graven images of her gods are broken into the ground." Now, just to note that one passage, you could read the whole chapter if you like, and we're going to go back to Isaiah chapter 13 for another passage to establish context. But who was in power, or should I say, to be in power, at the time that Isaiah is writing? A Bible chronology, I think, is absolutely crucial to our Bible study. I've mentioned in other studies that a good Bible map, when we mention cities and provinces and so forth, we need to have in our mind where these places are located. And to get events in order from a chronological standpoint is really helpful to your Bible study. To know when this prophet was prophesying, and who was empowered, who was it that was in power in other nations round about Israel? Often I think our Bible study is centered and focused only upon those who were Israelites, or those who were of the nation of Israel, as we speak of the United Kingdom and Judah as, after the divided kingdom. But consider when Isaiah prophesied. It was about 750 years before Christ came. Now, that would put us on the timeline as far as other nations are concerned. Who would be reigning during the time of Isaiah's prophecy? Babylon, or just maybe a little prior to that, perhaps even Assyria at this point. Because in Isaiah chapter 10, the prophet Isaiah talks about how that God is going to use Assyria to conquer the northern 10 tribes. But then later, Babylon is going to conquer Assyria, and you see that in Isaiah chapter 10, beginning in verse 5. So the mention of these nations sets a date, or an approximate date, on the timeline for when Isaiah is prophesying. Now, I'm looking out over the audience, and behind some masks I'm seeing, and perhaps you're not wearing a mask this morning, but I'm seeing some blank stares. Does that make sense to us? To get an idea of when the prophet prophesied, and then the things that he prophesied of. Well, let's go back to Isaiah chapter 10. Somebody told me a long time ago that if there has not been understanding, there has not been communication. And I believe that's so. So if we're lacking in our understanding of the context of Isaiah, then it's not going to really help us a lot. We need to see the context. In Isaiah chapter 10, we know that Assyria is going to be the instrument of God's wrath upon the northern 10 tribes of Israel. Look at verse 5. He said, "Ho, Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation, I will send him against a profane nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither does his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few." Now we read of some others in verses 8 and 9, but as you drop down to verse 10, he says, "And my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images did excel them, of Jerusalem and Samaria." Now tell me about Jerusalem and Samaria. What's the significance of these cities in particular? What was Jerusalem the capital of? The southern kingdom of Judah. What was Samaria the capital of? The northern kingdom of Israel. Which one fell first? Samaria did. The Assyrians conquered Samaria in about 722 B.C. And then, of course, the Babylonians caused the city of Jerusalem to fall. But when the Babylonians caused the city of Jerusalem to fall, they also had conquered Assyria. So all of those captives that were taken from the northern kingdom with the fall of Israel are now in control of the kingdom of Babylon. Now, if you'll note in the text, it says in verse 12, "Wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed the whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks." Now look carefully at the text. God said, "I'm going to use Assyria to destroy Israel. Samaria will fall to the Assyrians. But the king of Assyria, he's going to have a proud, arrogant heart and say, 'Look at all the things that I did, how great and beautiful I am.'" And God said, "I'm going to bring up the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, I'm going to bring him down." Read on. In verse 13, "For he saith, 'By the strength of my hand have I done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding, and I have removed the bounds of the peoples and have robbed the treasures, and like a valiant man I have brought down them that sit on the thrones. And my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the peoples, and as one gathereth eggs that are forsaken, have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved the wing, or that opened the mouth, or chirped.'" Now, isn't that a boast? The king of Assyria said that. "Look at all the wonderful things that I have done." Well, now wait a minute. Look at verse 5. "Ho, Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation." Do we not see that God used the king of Assyria? Though the text says it was not his will to do so, the king of Assyria didn't say, "I'm going to rise up against Israel and I'm going to conquer them to vindicate the cause of God." But did God use him? He sure did. And then when he said, "Look at what the great things I've done. I've conquered everybody and there's not anybody that can oppose me. I've conquered great cities and taken all their spoil and made their spoil my treasure." No, you didn't do that. God used you to do that. And he's going to use the Chaldeans to destroy you. Now, that was the lesson to the Old Testament prophet Habakkuk that we've talked about so much. Now, I hope I'm not boring you to tears with my enthusiasm of some of this Old Testament history. I think it's exciting. Because what we see is in the book of Revelation, God revealing that his plan is not done to these saints that are being martyred for the cause of Christ. They're going to be vindicated too. God takes control of those who would persecute them. Now, if you'll look in Isaiah chapter 13, let's be more specific. Isaiah chapter 13. Some of these Old Testament passages, brethren, I think are obscure to us simply because we just haven't studied them. And we need to, because it builds our faith to see what God has done and then what he promises to these in the book of Revelation, and see that he did that too. And that ought to provide for us hope. If you'll note Isaiah chapter 13, again, to establish context, he said, "The burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos did see, set ye up an ensign upon the bare mountain, lift up the voice unto them, wave the hand that they may go unto the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones, yea, have called my mighty men for mine anger, even my proudly exalted ones." Now drop down, if you will, to in the text. I read that to establish he's talking about judgment upon Babylon. Do we see that in chapter 13, verse 1? Now look at Babylon's arrogant boast, much like the king of Assyria. But in verse 17 it says, "Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, who shall not regard silver, and as for gold, they shall not delight in it, and their bows shall dash the young men in pieces, and they shall have no pity on the fruit of the womb, and their eyes shall not spare children." And Babylon. Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited. Neither shall there be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there. Neither shall shepherds make their flocks to lie down there. But wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures. And ostriches shall dwell there, and wild goats shall dance there, and wolves shall cry in their castles, and jackals in their pleasant palaces. And her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. What's God going to do to Babylon, the Chaldeans, and the great and wonderful city of the Chaldeans' pride? What's He going to do to it? Same thing He did to the Assyrians. He's going to use the Babylons to conquer the Assyrians, and here He tells us, "I'm going to raise up the Medes to conquer the Babylonians." Now, just to put that in perspective, when you think of major cities of the world today, what major cities might come to mind? Anybody? Washington, D.C. All right, can you think of another one? Paris, all right? These would be sufficient to help us to see these and their equivalents, where a great deal of culture and money and economy, I mean, just a great and fabulous cities. These would be comparable to the city of Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire. They would be comparable to Babylon, the city of the great Chaldeans. And can you imagine cities like this with all of their splendor and glorious structures and all of that so defeated and conquered that the ostriches and the lizards and the snakes and the doleful creatures live in their palaces because they're so deserted, they're conquered, they're lying ruins. And to the extent that even the shepherds would not stay there at night. Now, that gives us a backdrop of the wrath of God on these cities. Did those things happen to Nineveh? Yes. It fell. Did those things happen to Babylon? Yes, it fell. And if you'll note, Isaiah again prophesied in Isaiah chapter 45, 44, and 45. During this same time period, that God is going to raise up a king and his name is going to be Cyrus. And Cyrus is going to sign a decree releasing the Jews from captivity, and we'll talk more about that tonight. And they can go back and rebuild the city of Jerusalem that God used the Babylonians to destroy because now they've learned not to worship idols. But the Assyrians hadn't learned that. The Babylonians hadn't learned that. But Cyrus, the king of the Persians, he's going to let them go home and rebuild. Now the irony of that, at the time of Isaiah's prophecy, Cyrus hadn't been born yet. In fact, the Medo-Persian Empire had not been established yet. The Babylonians were not really in power fully yet at the time of Isaiah's prophecy. In fact, we're about 200 years before the time of Cyrus. And Isaiah named him by name. Now somebody said, how did Isaiah know that? Isaiah is revealing the prophecies that God gave to him regarding the fall of these nations. Now, when we look in Jeremiah, we're not going to do it this morning, but I would encourage you regarding Babylon and the fall of Babylon the Great. Go back and read what Jeremiah said about the fall of Babylon in Jeremiah chapter 50 and 51. Make a note of that. Go back and read it. Jeremiah chapter 50 and chapter 51. Now keep in mind that Babylon, and as the kingdom of Babylon, Chaldean. And Nineveh, as the capital of the Assyrian Empire, these become typical of God's judgment upon cities and nations like Sodom and Gomorrah because of their great wickedness. And they're not the only ones. I have on the board Tyre, and I want to call your attention again to the prophecy of Isaiah, because Isaiah was not just talking about the fall of Assyria or the fall of Babylon. He has much to say about the fall of Edom and the fall of Tyre and other wicked places during this period of time. And the language that is used in the book of Revelation just takes on added life when you compare it to the language that's found in the Old Testament regarding the judgment of God's wrath upon some of these Old Testament nations and cities. But in Isaiah chapter 23, I would encourage you to read that whole chapter. But we won't do that. We'll just cite a few verses in it. In verse 15, for example. Well, I've got to back up to verse 13. Verse 13, Isaiah 23, verse 13. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans. Now, we've made this point before, and we'll make it several times probably in the future. Don't be confused by the use of the term Chaldeans and the term Babylonians. For our purposes, they're the same. Okay? The Chaldeans and the Babylonians were the same. Sometimes the text uses one, sometimes it uses the other. And for our purposes, that's sufficient for us to note that. But you'll notice he said, this people was not. The Assyrian founded it for them that dwell in the wilderness. They set up their towers. They overthrew the palaces thereof. They made it a ruin. How, ye ships of Tarshish, for your stronghold is laid waste. Now that's very impressive to us as well when we begin to study from the map perspective. You remember where Tarshish is, and does that ring a bell to you? When Jonah was told to cry out against the city of Nineveh, keeping in mind that was the capital of the Assyrian Empire, what did Jonah do? He got on board a ship and wanted to go to Tarshish. Now if you look on your map, you'll note that Tarshish is way over here to the west in Spain. And Nineveh is way over here to the east as the capital of the Assyrian Empire. So he's trying to go as far away from where he needs to be as he possibly can. But the significance of Tarshish in this text is not Jonah. The significance of Tarshish in this text is Tyre. Because Tyre was a great commercial city. And you'll note that Tyre was on the coast of the land of Palestine, in the land of Canaan, if you please. And Tyre was a great commercial city across, all the way across the Mediterranean Sea, to the extent that it made Tarshish rich. But you'll notice in verse 15 what's going to happen to Tyre. It says, and it shall come to pass in that day that Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years. According to the days of one king, after the end of 70 years, it shall be unto Tyre as in the song of the harlot. Take the harp, go about the city, thou harlot. Thou hast been forgotten. Make sweet melody, sing many songs, that thou mayest be remembered. And it shall come to pass, after the end of 70 years, that Jehovah will visit Tyre, and she shall return to her hire, and shall play the harlot with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth, and her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness unto Jehovah. It shall not be treasured nor laid up, for her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before Jehovah to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. You can read on concerning God's judgments as it goes on. But what I want us to note is what happened to Tyre. God said Tyre going to fall. And you'll notice the terminology that's used in reference to Tyre. Tyre is referred to as a harlot. Now somebody said, when we read in the book of Revelation, we see that Babylon is referred to as a harlot. Well, Nineveh was also referred to as a harlot. And that paints for us a very vivid picture, does it not? Because what you see in that depiction is not a very nice person. Somebody who is paid for their services And when we look at Tyre, and we look at Babylon, and we look at Nineveh, and in the New Testament now, in the book of Revelation, when we look at Rome, do we not see the luxurious lifestyle, the money flowing, and those who were connected with any of these places were made rich because of their association with Tyre or Nineveh or Babylon or Rome. Now, take that thought with me. Let's go back to the book of Revelation. What do we see common between Tyre and Babylon and Rome? Well, these are ruling cities, and they were capitals in their own respect. All of these, whether we talk about Assyria or Babylon or Tyre, they thought themselves invincible. We're rich. There's no way on earth that we could ever be destroyed. And we saw that true and talked about it, I think, last time, did we not? With the city of Tyre that was destroyed earlier by Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire. And the city was left in ruins. And then Alexander the Great came along and he was going down toward Egypt. He wasn't interested in Tyre until they boasted that we built our new city out here on this island and we're in a fortress that's invincible. We cannot be destroyed. Aha! You think not? I'll accept your challenge. And you note that the Old Testament prophet said that the city of Tyre would be dumped into the sea, and so it was by Alexander the Great as he took the ruins of ancient Tyre and built a causeway in the sea out to the island city of Tyre, and he destroyed them. Probably the rule of thumb is, don't brag. But what we want to see is that God brought down those who existed with pride and arrogancy and thought that they were secure and invincible, that nothing could ever bring them to their knees. Well, that wasn't exactly true in Old Testament history, and it's not exactly true concerning Rome, because they are depicted with the same characterization. They would become a dwelling place for demons, a prison for every foul spirit, a cage for every unclean and hated bird. Randy had some comments about that, I think, last time, and I wanted to include in our study this morning Isaiah chapter 34, because that's the language that Isaiah uses, that hateful birds and unclean birds would occupy some of these places that were thought of as palaces in times gone by. The glorious pagan temples, during their heyday, they did not have the doleful creatures living in them. But they would. They would. And what have we learned in our study of Revelation 12 and 13 and somewhat even on into the 14th chapter, is that Satan's empire and ancient Rome in the text are intertwined. Especially you see that in the 13th chapter. Now, to get back to our text, let's notice that in the 18th chapter, the writer reveals in verse 3, he said, "For by the wine of the wrath of her fornication, all the nations are fallen, and the kings of the earth committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth waxed rich by the power of her wantonness." Now what we're seeing in this, and can you picture in your mind where Rome is, where the Mediterranean Sea is? I didn't include in this series of charts the map that I had on some others that depicted the empire of Rome all the way around the Mediterranean Sea. And it seemed to be the desire of the nations historically, if they could control, and certainly with Rome, about 200 miles inland, all the way around the Mediterranean Sea, then they'd really control the commerce of the world. That's how they would get rich. And considering, and I don't know if we've done a great deal of geographical study as far as from the standpoint of commerce is concerned, that's an interesting take on this. Who provided what? Who was rich with what across and around the Mediterranean Sea? But that in and of itself, I think, is helpful to see how that if Rome controls all of that, you see, the list of things are found in our text of the things that Rome would have power and control over. And these nations that John is writing about said, committed fornication with her. Well, we're not talking about literal fornication, but the point is their association or their ties with the Roman Empire was so closely intertwined that they had an intimate relationship with Rome, and it profited them very much economically. Now, to the people of God, what are they to do? Look at chapter 4. Now, or chapter 18, verse 4. We've noted a number of times in this study a passage that I think is just remarkable to set the tone for the things that are being discussed. And that's Revelation chapter 6, verses 9 through 11. In that context, we've noted that the martyrs, that is, those who have been beheaded for the cause of Christ, put yourself in that picture. Where would you be if you had been beheaded? You'd become a martyr because you're a Christian. Rather than to worship the emperor, rather than even one time a year give a little pinch of incense and burn that to the emperor and say, Lord God Caesar. Could you do that as a Christian? Just once a year? Well, you see, some Christians would compromise and say, well, I know it means nothing. But you can't do that. It does mean something. You can't affirm that. But to the Christians, they were crying out from under the altar, how long, O God, is this going to go on? God said, just a little while. And then the time of my wrath will be outpoured. Now, to those who are Christians, it says, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come forth, my people, out of her, that ye have no fellowship with her sins, and that ye receive not her plagues. Now, that just, boy, that's real helpful to our understanding, because who's this epistle written to? It's written to Christians that lived in Asia, the seven churches. And in that setting, we know that they're suffering and they're instructed, don't have any fellowship with all these evil things that are characteristic of Rome. Don't have fellowship with that. Now, what's the admonition to you, me, and historically? What was it that God called upon ancient people, Israel, to do? Deuteronomy chapter 7. To be a peculiar people. Don't intermarry with the heathen nations. Don't be like them because they'll corrupt you. You'll begin to worship idols. Don't do that. And when we read concerning God's people today, and I think I've got a passage or two on here, but we'll go ahead and get this next verse in front. He says, for her sins have reached even unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Verse 6, render unto her even as she rendered, and double unto her the double according to her works, in the cup which she mingled, mingle unto her double. Now God's saying, I'm going to pour out my wrath upon these folks. So don't you be caught up in it. Don't you be doing the things that are characteristic. But rather, you come out from among them. You separate yourselves from them. Now one of the things that we noted, as we looked at Jeremiah chapter 50, and again I would call your attention, study Jeremiah 50 and 51. At least read it. Be familiar with it. Because it's a pronunciation of God's wrath upon Babylon. And in verse 8, what did he say to the people of God? Don't get caught up in that. My wrath is coming. You don't get caught up in that. You separate yourself from it. Now some see a resemblance, and there is a resemblance between what's said here in Revelation chapter 18 and verse 4 and what's said in Matthew chapter 24 regarding the fall of the city of Jerusalem. You remember concerning the fall of the city of Jerusalem in Matthew chapter 24, Jesus said, when you look round about and you see the abomination of desolation. Now, how many of you have used that expression or heard it used? Say, well, we're talking about Germany or Russia. No, no, no. The abomination of desolation is identified in Luke's account of the same thing as the Roman armies. So if you're a citizen and you're a Christian in the city of Jerusalem, and you know that the Lord has said Jerusalem is going to fall, and it's going to fall soon, it's going to be really horrible. And when you look upon the hills around the city of Jerusalem and you see the Roman armies, what do? You run. You flee the city, lest you get caught up. You get away. Yeah. You run to the mountains. And pray that it's not in the wintertime. What happens in the mountains in the wintertime? Cold, snow, yeah. So you pray it's not in the wintertime. Pray that you're not with child. Why? Be difficult to run, yeah, when you're 8, 9 months pregnant, wouldn't it? Okay. So you pray these things. But when you see the Roman army, you get out. Get out of Dodge, because I'm going to destroy it. Now, to these Christians that John is writing to, what's he saying to them? You don't get caught up in all this evil stuff that's characteristic of emperor worship and worshiping the empire and idolatry and all these kinds of things. You don't get caught up in all that, because my judgment's going to come. Now, to you today as a Christian, what do you do when you look round about and you see evil things like is characteristic of some of these pagan cities that existed in ancient times? Or perhaps I should say, when you see some of the sin that exists in the big cities and even in the countrysides round about us, what do you do? What's your decision about how you should live your life? You don't get caught up in that stuff. Now why? Well, why don't you want to practice fornication and adultery and idolatry and homosexuality? Why don't you want to do all those things? No, I want to go to heaven. Yeah, I don't want to be a part of God's judgment upon those ugly things, because we see in laundry list of passages, for example, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 9 through 11, Galatians chapter 5, beginning in verse 19 through 21, the writer concludes that list and says, they who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. And you read that expression a number of times, you want to go to heaven? You can't go to heaven and associate yourself with these things. So to these Christians in the book of Revelation, he said, you come out. You don't have any fellowship with her sins, that ye receive not her plagues. Now, isn't that simple? We see that admonition over and over and over again. We call your attention to 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14, beginning, where that text simply says, be not unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness and iniquity? Or what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what portion hath a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement hath a temple of God with idols? For we are a temple of the living God. Even as God said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and they shall be my people. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore come ye out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch no unclean thing, and I will receive you. And I will be to you a father, and ye shall be to me sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. See, you don't have fellowship with those kind of things. I want you to belong to me. Live a different kind of life. The warning to the Ephesians, which has become somewhat of a favorite, I guess, go-to passage of mine, Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 17 through chapter 5, about verse 11. The writer is calling upon those who were converted from a Gentile background. Here's how you used to live. Don't go back and live that way. Well, then you lived in fornication, you lied, you would steal, you'd do all these ugly things. Don't live that way. But not only don't you live that way, he said, have no fellowship with those who live that way, but rather even reprove them. So this is not a new thought. We see it in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32. Use this passage extensively. 5 minutes.
That's it.
Thank you much. And he concludes that thought with, those who practice these things are worthy of death. So don't live that way. You don't have any fellowship with that. And that's what John is writing in Revelation chapter 18 and in verse 4. Now why? Well, because her sins are going to be remembered. They've reached to heaven. And God will render unto her according to her works. Now what do we know about God's wrath? You reap what you sow. Isn't that simple? You reap what you sow. You sow according to the flesh, then that's what you're going to reap. You sow according to the Spirit, then that's what you're going to reap. Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 and 8. So don't live this way, but rather choose to live this way. Now, Rome was about to receive what was due. Now, this balancing of scales, I think, is very important. Look at verse 6. He said, render unto her even as she rendered, and double unto her double, according to her works. In the cup which she mingled, mingle unto her double. Now, this passage is not, as some have concluded, teaching that, well, Rome does this, and so God's going to double whatever Rome does, and that'll be his judgment. No, no. He's describing what Rome does as double. And then what will be the opposing side, the judgment of God? He will render double. If Rome does this, double, then I'll do this, double. So you have an equaling of the scales, a balancing of the scales, which is consistent with what Galatians 6, 7, and 8 says. You reap what you sow. Now that's the balancing of it. Now in verse 7, notice he continues. He says, how much soever she glorified herself and waxed wanton, so much give her of torment and mourning. Now she put herself on a pedestal, I'll bring her down. And then in verse 7 he continues, for she saith in her heart, I sit a queen and am no widow. I shall in no wise see mourning. Oh, that's so impressive. What is it that Rome is boasting? Much like what we saw concerning Tyre. Much like what we saw concerning Babylon. Well, I'm up here on the pedestal. Nobody can take me down. And that's what Rome is saying. I sit as a queen. I am no widow. I shall in no wise see mourning. Oh, not true. Not true at all. Because you will. And you'll notice in the verse following, therefore, in one day shall her plagues come, death, mourning, famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judged her. Now, I want to call your attention. I have some passages over on the side, and for lack of time, we'll not read them, but perhaps you will read them. One of the things that we've noted is the expression one day. We're going to come across that again. Its equivalent in the text would be 1 hour. We'll see that again a little bit later. We're not talking about 24 hours and we're not talking about 60 minutes. That's not what God is expressing in this passage. But when you think about the judgment of God occurring in a day, or the judgment of God occurring in an hour, fit that now with language we've already used in the book of Revelation, as John records, behold, I come quickly. You see, he's not talking about how many minutes it takes. He's talking about the suddenness of it. With all the boast of these mighty empires in times gone by, and God brought his judgment upon them, did they expect it? Did they expect it? Did Nineveh expect to fall? Did Tyre? Did Babylon? Well, no. No, they thought that they were secure and that they would never be defeated. But they were. They certainly were. And did it take God a long time to bring his wrath upon them? No. He brought them down. They didn't expect it. And so judgment came. And so it will be with Rome. God would bring Rome down as a mighty world empire. It would not last. Now, one of the things I want to call to your attention, again, is Daniel chapter 7, verse 11. Because in that text, we've noted a number of times that Daniel, prophesying about 650 years before Jesus came, said during the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonians, that these earthly kingdoms will be destroyed, beginning with yours. And Babylon did fall. The Medes and the Persians conquered it. The Medes and the Persians empire, it did fall. Alexander the Great conquered it. But the Greek empire fell. Rome conquered it. And what then does Daniel say about Rome? The fourth empire? It will fall too. And it did. It fell too. So these world empires that thought they were indestructible found out they were not quite as indestructible as they thought they were. Okay? But that's what we're studying in the 18th chapter. And I'll insert a blank slide just here. I'll try to begin with that next time. All right.